From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Mary Mazzio's documentary, Underwater Dreams, raises a question. What if you were able to level the playing field in education, and not in everything, but in certain things? What if you took one group of students who were usually at a disadvantage, and you gave this group an opportunity? You gave them some time, some attention. Could they not only succeed, but could they compete against the best? Mazzio's film is about four Latino students from a high school in Arizona who entered a national underwater robotics competition right alongside teams from Cal Poly and MIT, and this group won. The film, though, isn't about building a robot. It's about building a culture and a legacy. And today in the program, we're talking about the lessons from the film, the obstacles, and the opportunities. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. There are two important parts to Mary Mazzio's documentary film, Underwater Dreams. The most dramatic part, the part you may have heard of, is the competition part. Her film is the story of a team of high school students from Arizona who entered a national underwater robotics competition. They're competing with the cream of the crop in the U.S., teams from universities, MIT, Cal Poly, teams that can afford stainless steel enclosures and state-of-the-art components. These kids make their contraption out of PVC sprinkler pipe from the Home Depot. And I guess it's no real spoiler to say they shock everybody by winning the competition. But there's another part to the film. It's what happens after the competition, what happened to the four boys who had the wit and intelligence to pull this off, because the boys are undocumented immigrants. And that fact defines what happens next. Mazzio points out there are something like 2 million undocumented students in this country, and only a fraction of them will go to college. Many states require the undocumented to pay out-of-state tuition rates for universities, and they're not eligible for financial aid. Today in the program, we're talking about this film and the lessons it offers for America's political and educational system. Mary Mazzio is a filmmaker focused on American social issues, former attorney. She also happens to be a former Olympian. She was a rower in the 1992 Olympic Games. And she directed Underwater Dreams. She's joining us today from a studio in Boston. Mary Mazzio, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, Doug, thank you for having me. Delighted to be with you today.
Let me mention, there's going to be a screening of the film tomorrow night. The Hinckley Institute of Politics is screening the film. It's all part of their Siciliano Forum. It's their annual forum focused on a wide variety of public policy issues. This year's theme for the Hinckley is the future of U.S. Latin American relations. They're going to be screening the film tomorrow night at 7 at the Tower Theater. We'll give you, as I said, more details a little bit later. So, Mary Mazzio, when did you first hear this story? Did you like see it on the news, read it in the papers? What was it?
So a teacher had actually sent me the story years ago. Now, this is an event that happened in 2004.
Yeah.
And so I heard about the story, I think, in early 2005, and I thought, oh, this is phenomenal. And I started Googling, and I saw there was an extraordinary article in Wired magazine written by Josh Davis. Yeah. And when I saw that article, which was really well written, I said, oh, this is an epic David and Goliath story. How remarkable. So I call up the teachers involved and they said, oh, it's so nice to hear from you, but we're signing a deal with Warner Brothers.
Right.
And so I went, oh, you know, expletive.
Yeah.
oh, what a story. And every year I would call, every year Warner Brothers would roll over their rights. And the teachers and the boys started following the kinds of films that I was doing and the kind of press we were getting. And so over the years, you know, I think about 3 years ago, one of the teachers said, you know, Mary, if anybody's going to do this documentary, we really would love for you to do it. And the next time we have an opportunity, we're going to ask Warner Brothers if they'll allow you to, you know, shave off the documentary rights.
Right.
And I thought, oh, how wonderful. Of course, that's, you know, hell will freeze over before that's going to happen.
Yeah.
But what a wonderful gesture. And as it happened, about 15 months ago or however, the Warner Brothers rights, their rights lapsed and they didn't re-up as they had every other year prior to that. And so the teachers and the boys said, okay, we're going to sign consents. You're off and running. And literally not 30 days later did I get a call from Josh, who wrote the Wired magazine, and he said, you know, Lionsgate now wants to make a feature film with actors, and they're wondering who the hell you are.
Right.
So that's what happened. And honestly, given the traction and the amazing things that are happening and that have happened with the film and the impact that it's having, particularly in low-income classrooms, I am so humbled that the teachers and the boys really trusted me with this story. And not just the boys, but the young women, too, that came in the wake of this event that really springboarded into really remarkable achievements in science and mathematics and engineering. So anyways, that's the long and the short of it.
Yeah. So they're still thinking about a feature film.
In fact, the feature film just came out this month, and it's called Spare Parts, and it stars George Lopez. It's a smaller movie, so I think it debuted in about 400 or 500 cinemas, and it will soon go to cable and DVD and Blu-ray and such. But that actually just came out. But as you can imagine, that gave us great impetus to move and move quickly. And so we made this film really in record time, and we had just remarkable partnerships all along the way. So AMC Theaters, as an example, we partnered with AMC, which not only brought us out theatrically, but they gifted screenings across the country so that if you were an educator, and this happened in the fall, if you were an educator and you could bring at least 100 kids to the theater, you could see Underwater Dreams free of charge. And we were inundated.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I thought, oh, how great. And then I was a little bit unprepared, and as was my team, for the onslaught of that opportunity. We had sometimes upwards of 1,000 kids seeing this film in different areas across the country. So that was so exciting.
So why do you figure it, why did it get the traction that it did? What does that say, do you think, about how people are thinking about all of this?
Well, I think, you know, we had traction in two levels. One was we saw something really interesting. So full disclosure, I am a Democrat and I skew fairly left, but I produce this with Jeb Bush Jr., who does not skew left. And so that, I think our relationship, and we got to be very good friends, our relationship mirrored what we saw happening politically. We saw groups to the left and groups to the right. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, for example, opened their West Coast office with this film. I mean, think about that for a second, right? The chamber tends to be fairly conservative, very pro-business oriented, often at odds with the Obama administration. That was really exciting. We also fielded calls from Libre. Libre is a group funded by the Koch brothers. And they said, how do we get involved with this? Now, mind you, the film was done, so there was no altering the content. So that kind of traction we saw was phenomenal, where this film could bring together different points of view and create dialogue, right, as opposed to people getting really upset and sort of using rhetoric. So that was number one. Number two, we had a screening about a month ago in Napa, primarily for the sons and daughters of migrant workers, right? About 1,000 middle schoolers showed up for this screening. And, you know, my heart is out of my chest because we had done a number of screenings, but 1,000 middle schoolers, this is an unruly crowd, right? You've got 11, 12, and 13-year-olds. And I thought, oh my goodness, you know, we're showing them the 85-minute version of this film. That's asking a lot of these kids. you and when the film started rolling, like the kids started cheering at the opening frame, and I thought, okay, this is good, but how long is this going to last, right?
Yeah.
And then you know, you could hear a pin drop, and when you have kids that are that young, that can grasp the message and honestly take away the message that these four boys and their two teachers laid down, that something more was possible. And we had a little girl raise her hand. I mean, the kids, you know, waving their hands with all kinds of questions. After the screening, one little girl, and this really, I got chills and my hair stood on end. One little girl raised her hand. She said, you know, because of my culture, I never really thought I would amount to anything. But after seeing your film, you know, I'm kind of a strong person. I'm going to go do something big. I just want to let you know that.
Right? That's nice, yeah.
And you know, for a film to kind of speak, I mean, I'm a blue-eyed white hockey mom, right? What do I know? But to be able to kind of transcend, you know, experience and race and time so that somebody can absorb a message where they feel empowered, they feel inspired, and they're inspired because of the courage and the chutzpah that these four boys and their two teachers had. And so really all we've done is we've taken this story and inspiration that the four boys and the two teachers had in this community in Phoenix, and we've put a spotlight on it so that others can identify with that story and identify with those boys.
Yeah. I want to take us through the story. Let me ask you this, though. I mentioned that the film has two parts. You know, there's the competition part, which is amazing, and I want to work through that as well because that's really great, obviously. But then there's the part about what happens next, which almost seems as poignant, you know, as dramatic. I mean, did you see that coming, that it would have parts like that?
Great question, Doug. I did not see that coming. I thought when we started this process that it would really be the story of the competition and, you know, cue up the French horns and, you know, big orchestral swells. Anybody can do it. Well, it wasn't until, you know, I said, you know, it's really worth investigating the impact that this had on the community and what changed. I mean, Carl Hayden was a gang school. Right. You had many young people dropping out of school, if not the sixth grade, then the ninth grade. There were incredible poverty, incredible pressure on many of these young people to work. Right. And to help the family survive. And so I thought, you know, wouldn't it be interesting to investigate that second piece? What was the impact that these boys had on their community? And when I started talking to the young men and women, and there were some extraordinary women, by the way, several of the women talked about what happened. You know, Carl Hayden, since that time, has been sending a steady stream of engineering students to ASU.
Right.
I mean, what a remarkable legacy these boys have had. But in Arizona, Proposition 300 was passed. And what that did, it really meant that if you were an undocumented student, any form of financial aid by a state university was deemed to be a public benefit for which you no longer qualified.
Right.
And so when I found out, so many of these students started talking about the challenges of Proposition 300. And then I found out that the founders of the Arizona Dream Act Coalition, which was formed primarily by ASU students at risk, right? These were undocumented students, and they were trying to organize themselves to solve this problem. Most of the founders of the Arizona Dream Act Coalition came from Carl Hayden Robotics Team.
Right.
And I said to myself, I said to the kids, I said, wait a minute. You're going off to be an engineer. This is so cool. I get that. But what is with the social activism? Like, how did that come about? And they looked at me as if I like was born with a single brain cell, right? And they said, Mary, as an engineer, we are taught how to solve a problem.
Right.
Like, this is a problem. We need to solve it. That's why we organized ourselves. And I was blown away by, A, that sort of logical thinking, that this was a problem to be solved and they had been trained appropriately to think about it that way. And also to be 19, 20, 21 years old, to use your voice in a way where these young people were putting themselves completely at risk for deportation. They were coming out of the shadows and they were doing, I mean, in my mind, this was the next generation of young civil rights leaders. They were praying. When I saw footage of the vigils that they would hold, I mean, it wasn't screaming and yelling and F you. It was completely the opposite. It was so respectful. These young people would get together. They would pray. They would hold hands. They were praying for change. They were praying that something would intervene so that they could see their way towards achievement and success. And for me, again, you see an 18, 19-year-old actually have this kind of courage, irrespective of the consequences. I was blown away. Mm. So Doug, I really was not prepared for that.
Let's talk a little bit about Carl Hayden Community High School. This is in west. It's west of Phoenix, north of the desert, I think, is how you put it in the film. So explain what it's like, because on one level, it seems like, I mean, you set this up. It's 90% Latino, most below the poverty line, lots of gang activity, which you mention in the film. But so on one level, it seems like this kind of challenged traditional high school. But then on the other hand, it has a remarkable group of teachers, and they seem to be the difference. I mean, what makes this high school so special?
I think you just put your finger right on it. And that is that you had these two extraordinary teachers at great personal, I think, they gave up so much time and energy in many ways being surrogate fathers, right? Freddie Largevardi and Alan Cameron, mm-hmm. The time and the effort that they put into these young people. I mean, Freddie would be at school and Alan as well at 7 a.m. and they would not leave until 7 or 8 at night. Many of these young people sought the robotics lab. It was a refuge for them. Right. Many of these students would wake up or they would come home and they would find that their mother had been deported. Their father had been deported. There were so many challenges that these young people were facing. And Freddie and Alan, basically with sort of a mixture of tough love, said, "You are capable. There is no excuse." And Freddie had this great line and he said, "Listen, if you're going to be deported, would you rather be a garbage man, or would you rather be deported as a skilled engineer? Think what you can do if you're a skilled engineer." And that was what he inculcated in these students. And I think that kind of commitment, there are so many wonderful teachers across the country. These two teachers in particular went above and beyond. And robotics, they made it captivating for the kids, right? So again, to see this steady stream of kids talking a language about vectors and physics and, you know, controlling gizmos that will whir and, you know, language that, frankly, I don't understand, yeah. Right? As a non-technical person, to see these young people talking in this fashion and then pursuing a love of building things. I mean, fundamentally, that's what it is. These teachers are encouraging a love of building things and solving problems. And it's you know, the kids get so fired up. And so, again, you see this steady stream where they go off primarily to ASU in the engineering programs. And many of these kids have come out as skilled engineers.
I want to play a clip from the film. I want to hear from Freddie Largevardi and Alan Cameron. You mentioned the two really crucial players in this story, the teachers, because they're talking about what they were up against with these students. Again, lots of gang activity, expectations, I think is really the critical point in this clip,
right?
Anyway, are very, very low. And it's interesting, you tell the story of Freddie and Alan. Freddie comes, his parents come from Tehran during the big conflict when the hostage crisis in the late 70s. He feels like he's an American, but he's also an Iranian. So there's that conflict there. Alan Cameron's an interesting story, son of a bus driver, loses his father early on, goes into the Navy in Vietnam. So all of these backstories are interesting. It's interesting that you chose to tell that that part of this story, their backstory as well, because it is about this idea of them and their relationship to the country, but also their relationship, it seems, to their to their own fathers. I guess you saw that connection early on, I suppose.
I did. And in fact, many of these young people saw Freddie as a father figure. And they say that in the film. And I thought that was fascinating, particularly because Freddie had an absentee father.
Right.
Right. And he in the film talks about his own conflict with his one son. He has one son that's autistic, and the burden that his wife had to really share or take primary responsibility for, because he was spending so much time at school being a surrogate father and encouraging these young people. And his wife, you know, she said, listen, oh boy, were there times when I wanted to wring his neck? Absolutely. She said, but the investment that Freddie is making in these young people, it's a calling. That's priceless.
Yeah. Here's a clip. This is Freddie Lajvardi and Ellen Cameron from Mary Mazzio's film Underwater Dreams.
All you can do is try to talk to the parents and say, I know you don't have enough money at home. I know you want him to work. But if you can let him go to school, if you can let him go to college, then everything could be different.
The hardest obstacle they have is low and wrong expectations.
Mary Mazzio is with us. She's director of the film Underwater Dreams. Tomorrow night at 7 at the Tower Theater, the Hinckley Institute of Politics is going to be screening it. It's part of their Siciliano Forum on U.S.-Latin American Relations. Oscar Vasquez, whom we're going to talk about here when we get back from a break, he's going to be at the screening on hand for a Q&A. I think that's a big deal, and you'll see why as we talk about Oscar a little bit later in the program. We should also mention there are a limited number of free copies of the educational version of the film available to Title I schools and educators, and you can get details about all of that at radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we are profiling a documentary film that explores the hurdles and the promises of education. It's about a team of undocumented high school students from Arizona who entered a national underwater robotics competition with the likes of the MIT team, and these high school kids won. The director, Mary Mazzio, is with us, a filmmaker focused on American social issues. The film is called Underwater Dreams. It's screening tomorrow night at the Tower Theater. The Hinckley Institute of Politics is screening it. It's a part of their annual Siciliano Forum. We'll give you details about that. Mary Mazzio is joining us from a studio in Boston. All right, so let's meet the kids, because they're terrific. And funny. Yeah, we should say that it is really funny. I have to say, the film is really funny. They're funny guys. Their relationship is funny. Their relationship to Freddie and Alan is funny. But let's go through them. Lorenzo Santillan. Say something about him. He has a mullet.
Love Lorenzo, and you know, so I've gotten to know all of these guys really, really well. We've traveled together, we've done events together, and Lorenzo is hilarious. I mean, he's sort of the jokester. He is so unscripted and raw. And when we've done events, I mean, he's spellbinding because he's so honest about his personal situations, about the artificial impediments to success, as well as his own internal limitations. Mm-hmm. And he's just as honest and funny and imaginative as they come.
Luis Aranda, he's the strong, silent, gentle, loyal type, I guess.
He is, and he is a gentle giant. I mean, I have never met somebody with such, I think Alan called it situational awareness. Right. You know, we'll be going, I'm directionally impaired, and I'll say, okay, guys, anybody know where we're going? Luis will have mapped the wherever it is that we're going out in his head. He knows who's where. He knows where the exits are. He is just remarkable. We were fortunate to attend the Hispanic Heritage Foundation awards in Washington, D.C. And unfortunately, at the end of the show, the theater caught on fire, which you never want to do. But Luis was like, he knew where the exits were. He knew where he shepherded us to safety. And he's amazingly bright, very, very quiet and doesn't say a lot. But boy, when he says something, you better pay attention.
Yeah, he's a powerful figure, I have to say, in the film without, as you said, saying much. Christian Arcega, self-assured, intelligent, describes himself as a bit of a loner.
He is a loner and, yes, slightly misanthrope, but unbelievably, I think he's a genius. Of the group, he actually told me about a month ago that he can read a page of text in four blinks. His intellect is, in a word, dizzying. And again, to see young people in areas and zip codes and neighborhoods that are so often overlooked, this kind of talent and intellect and capability, I think it's actually a really exciting proposition.
Let's talk about Oscar Vasquez, who is, he's the leader, such a charismatic figure. People will get to meet him tomorrow night if they come to the screening, which I highly recommend. But tell us about Oscar. He's a remarkable kid.
He's an amazing boy. Does he eat steel for breakfast? Does he eat, you know, nails? He is the kind of person that he has achieved through sheer force of will. So he had always wanted to be, he enrolled in ROTC during high school, always wanted to serve in the military. It was his lifelong dream. And it wasn't until he was a junior in high school that he found out he couldn't serve because he was undocumented.
Right.
And so he got himself through ASU with an engineering degree. And he got various commendations at ASU. And he was had married an American woman and said to her, I don't want to be lifting rocks for a living. Like, I need to do something dramatic. And so he reported himself to Homeland Security and deported himself.
Right.
I mean, this was hugely risky, because if you do that and you're here unauthorized, you face a 10-year ban from ever coming back. He had a baby on the way, an American baby on the way. And it was a 1 in a billion chance that his story, Dick Durbin heard about his story and went to the Senate floor and talked about dreamers that could really move this country forward, particularly Oscar having an engineering degree and Oscar's wish to serve in the military. So Oscar's first visa application, stamped, denied.
Yep.
Second, denied. Third. It wasn't until about, I think, 18 months later that he got a letter from Homeland Security that said, welcome back. And so what did he do within 6 months of arriving back on American soil? He enlisted in the Army and went to boot camp. He's got a degree in engineering. He didn't go to officer candidate school. And I said, you know, what was your thinking? And he said, I wanted to enlist. That's how I felt I owed it to America. Right. Really interesting. And so he served a tour of duty in Afghanistan. And he is very lucky to be here. He doesn't like talking about his military service, but suffice it to say that his father got down on his hands and knees when Oscar came back.
Yeah.
He recently finished his military service, and he has started with a company, and he's in a science and technical position where he oversees huge industrial railroad repairs. And Oscar is the type of person. Let me share this story with you, Doug. We were invited to go on the Colbert Report.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so I am sweating bullets because, most people like you, Doug, are wonderful to speak with. But I knew that with Stephen Colbert that anything was possible and that I could look like a total bleep. And so I was sweating all day. And Oscar said to me in the green room, he said, you know, Mary, I've never seen you nervous. You look a little nervous. And I said, well, I just don't know what's going to be fired at me. And I know that you're safe, but I am not. And Oscar laughed and he said, you know, Mary, when you've served and come under fire, like, nothing fazes you. And I thought, that's Oscar. He is, everything is in perspective. He knows what his priorities are, and he's really extraordinary. And the fortitude and courage that that young man has, he is more American than I am.
There's a interesting theme in the film I wanted to ask you about. And there's this, of course, as we've sort of given this part away, it's the they win this competition. They win up against, and we meet the team from MIT, for example.
Right.
And they're great. I think that their perspective is really interesting, which plays against these four boys. And you get a sense of the contrast going on and just resources, opportunity, all of those kinds of things. I mean, it's really, you don't have to beat us over the head for it to become really apparent and just the optics of all of that. But there's this theme that is interesting. After they win, it seems like they all wonder, okay, was this legit? Like, in some way, it's a subjective contest in some ways. Did we actually win fair and square? And I want to play a clip. You'll hear Oscar in this clip from the film, but also others from the competition and from some from the MIT team, because the question was, not only did they win legitimately, but what's the best way to approach a problem? Do you go complicated, complex, or do you go simple? Here's a clip from Underwater Dreams.
I don't know if we were graded on the same curve, I guess.
A certain amount of the score is subjective, so we might keep in mind that one team had less resources than the other.
We had, you know, tons of resources. What they did have was they had ingenuity and they had creativity. Even though they may not have had the education or the courses to explain it, they knew what they were doing.
There was no doubt in my mind that they deserved to win that.
The competition is actually a good reflection of real life. You know, we went in really focused on the technical elements, but if you want to succeed, you have to have good presentation skills, you have to have things documented well, and we kind of forgot about that.
We may have had the technically superior vehicle, but we weren't selling it perhaps as well as Carl Hayden did.
I thought it was really awesome to like see this high school team really do a good job and beat out, you know, top colleges that were there.
They definitely earned it.
It was brilliant.
Talk a little bit about that, because MIT had an amazing vehicle for sure. Their robot was really cool looking and complicated, and that's the point. The boys from Carl Hayden didn't. They simplified it, and that seemed almost seems like an engineering lesson as much as anything else.
It really was, and you know, the boys, and I think one of the things that I know really impressed the judges was the boys, when they first got to the competition, their robot was leaking, right? And so they walk in, they're the only Hispanic team, they've got a crappy-looking robot, right, of PVC, and they see these shiny, beautiful works of art with ExxonMobil stickers right around the pool. And then they put in their robot, who they had named Stinky, hilariously. And Stinky really did stink. Stinky sank. And so the boys were sort of distraught. And then they were like, well, wait a minute. Let's figure out this problem. And one of the boys said, well, what's that stuff in diapers? Desiccant. And Lorenzo said, well, a diaper is way too, that's not, what about a tampon? Right. And so the boys actually, the fact that they came up with the using a tampon to fix a problem, how creative is that? Right. And so they used 8 Super Plus tampons to fix the leak. And the judges, you know, when the judges came, is that what I think it is? You know, right. Yes, it is, in fact. And I think the judges thought that was so innovative. And that's exactly what engineering is all about, right? How do you fix something on the fly? You know, you may be on a huge ship at sea and not have things other than tampons, right? And so I think that was something the boys approached their robot to solve a problem really simply. And MIT, they wanted to just do as complex sort of wild engineering as they could. Now, in fact, MIT won the mission part, right? Putting your robot in, having it do all the tasks, the grabber, the sonar,
right.
They won that pretty much going away. But that was only 50% of all of the points. where Carl Hayden came up right out of the blue, right? Like kind of the sleeper team, was that they were so prepared and they had worked on a paper, right? MIT left the paper until the last evening, right? Mm-hmm. They worked on their presentation over and over and over again. And so that approach, which is both being prepared, being able to communicate your idea, as well as approaching the problem with simplicity, that really put them over the top. And then, Doug, the second thing that you alluded to was, were they judged fairly,
right,
or were they given the pity factor, right? So, in fact, the first award was this new judges award that hadn't been announced, and Carl Hayden was called up, and all the boys said, okay, yeah, this is the pity award.
Right.
This is the four Hispanic kids that aren't going to get anything else, right? And it wasn't until after that when they won the design award. And they started winning these awards. Now, I went back and I asked several judges, right? Like, did you score these fairly and unfairly?
Right.
The reality is, much of the competition was objective. Did your robot grab the bell, right? Did your robot, were you able to measure depth? Were you able to measure temperature? Those were immutable scores. There was no subjectivity whatsoever. And each judge submitted their scores independently, right? Now, the piece that could have been scored subjectively would have been the poster, right? MIT failed to put the name of their school, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, right? So they lost points there. And the boys actually were able to communicate and defend their robot in English, of course, that being their second language,
that's right.
Right? And so I'm sure some of the judges were impressed by that. But again, that's life, right? Life is how you present yourself, and some of it was subjective. But it's interesting because the chief judge, who's actually in the film, he said, hands down, this team truly deserved to win, not only for their presentation, but how they approach their leaking robot, right? That kind of engineering is really exciting to see that in action. There were a couple of judges. There was one judge who sent me a 4-page email that said, well, these boys won, but they won on things that didn't matter. And what he meant to say by that was that MIT won the engineering piece in the water, right, with the various tasks that they had to do. And everybody acknowledges that Carl Hayden really, they were able to win because of their preparation on the other parts of the competition, right? They had to defend their robot and they had to do a poster and then, of course, a technical paper. And that's where they won. And they only defeated MIT by, I think it was like a point and a half.
Right.
So this was like neck and neck. And, you know, the MIT kids, however, were so gracious. And they were like, you know what? Those guys deserve to win because this is like real life. You can build the greatest engineering tool, but if you can't communicate what it's all about or you don't deliver on time, you don't get the job. You don't get paid. And I thought that was so genuine and it was so gracious because there was no arrogance, there was no spite. And the fact that this MIT team viewed Carl Hayden as their peers and as fellow engineers, I mean, that said it all.
Mm. Mary Mazzio is with us, director of Underwater Dreams. The film is screening at the Tower Theater tomorrow night at 7. It's part of the Hinckley Institute of Politics Siliano Forum. One of the, he's a young man now, is Oscar Vasquez. He's going to be on hand for the Q&A following the film. Our website has all the details, radiowest.kuer.org. We need to take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with director Mary Mazzio. We're talking about her film Underwater Dreams, which the Hinckley Institute of Politics is going to be screening tomorrow night at the Tower Theater. We'll give you more details as we go along. The film is a profile of a team of four undocumented high school students from Arizona who enter a national underwater robotics competition and they win. Mary Mazzio is joining us from Boston. I want to play another, which I have to say was one of the most powerful parts of this film. I'm guessing a lot of people agree. There's this moment when, I think it's 10 years later after all of this plays out, and the four young men from Arizona make their way to MIT. They weren't able to go at the time for all the kind of complications that you would imagine, but they're able to go there and meet the people, you know, go to be on the campus of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which is really extraordinary, to meet the members of the team that they had beat back in 2004. But there's this moment where they're all in this classroom or this area talking, and some of the MIT, the members of that team, are talking about what they're doing now. And it's such a remarkable moment. Let me play this clip, and then we can talk about it from the film Underwater Dreams.
So I'm Kurt Steele. This is Jordan Stanway.
I work at Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute on some long-range AUVs.
I make Apple accessories for Apple ear pods. That was my baby. So it's cool to see, like, when I go on the subway and you see someone using your headphones, you're like, oh yeah, those are mine.
So I'm working for Bluefin Robotics these days, building underwater robots as well. We helped out with the search for Amelia Earhart last summer.
I work for Teledyne Web Research, and we make underwater gliders. And next month I'm going down to Antarctica to fly gliders.
So what are you guys up to?
Yeah.
And everything just sort of stops. Like the movie comes to this halt because they're like, so, you know, I work for Apple and I'm doing these amazing things. What are you guys up to? Would you talk about that moment? Because it's really kind of, this is a really powerful point.
You know, it was so organic, right? Because you never know what you're going to capture in these kind of situations. And the boys were... you could see the discomfort with which MIT, they were listening with rapt attention. But, you know, Lorenzo started in, he said, well, I'm pretty much as far from engineering as you can get.
Yeah.
Right. And so each of the boys talked about their jobs, right, and what they were able to accomplish or not accomplish in the face of really serious obstacles and limitations that they faced, of course, that the MIT students didn't face.
Well, let's mention some of this, because I mean, Lorenzo, for example, he as you said, he turned left and he went and did a catering business, so he's paying the bills with a catering business. Luis helps him out from time to time. He's on a janitorial crew.
Right.
Christian, he goes to ASU on a full scholarship. The scholarship is revoked under this Proposition 300. He's said at one point, I'm not sure where he is these days, but at one point Christian mentions this genius you talked about earlier, barely making minimum wage.
Right.
You know, here's a kid who could be at Stanford or MIT or Cal Poly, should be contributing to society, and he was getting minimum wage.
Right.
And then you already talked about Oscar. Oscar having to go and deport himself, really, to be able to move forward. I mean, that's pretty telling.
It was, and we had some. I'll share with you, Doug, that we had a pre-screening with some college kids. As we were right before we were launching the film into theaters this summer, and a bunch of college students said, yeah, we want you to take that section out. And I said, wow. And I said, why? And they, well, it makes us feel really uncomfortable. And I said, good, go do something about it. Right. I mean, people were expecting, they wanted the Rocky story.
Yeah.
And they wanted to know that it was kind of a nice Hollywood ending and they could leave without thinking further about this. And I have to tell you, we also had a screening in Washington, D.C. with a boys prep school, very affluent. I mean, these were the future leaders, captains of industry. Right. And the boys crowded around me. There were like 100 kids and they descended on me and they said, oh, yeah. Oh, my God, that was so funny. The tampon. And then another boy said, yeah, I got so mad when I found out what they were doing now. And another boy said, yeah, in the scene where the bus is starting to pull out, the deportation bus, and I had a tear roll down. And all the boys looked at each other and they said, yeah, we thought we were going to cry, too. And then one of the boys, one of the leaders, looked at me and said, what can we do? This is so unfair. And you had all these heads nodding in agreement. And I thought, okay, go do something, boys, right? Like, this is your opportunity to actually do something. And so by leaving that scene in, it is uncomfortable, right? It does make you think, what is it? You know, we live in a land of opportunity where if you work hard, you should be able to pull yourself up by the bootstraps. That's what America is all about. And for these young people not to be able to have that American dream, even though they truly are American in every way except for paperwork, I think it struck young people as patently unfair.
There are, as I pointed out earlier, and you mentioned in the film, 2 million undocumented students, a fraction of which go to college. By 2018, you point out that it's believed there will be some 1.2 million unfulfilled STEM jobs. Talk about that.
Well, that has global and catastrophic implications for our competitiveness, right, as a country. If our American companies, which are struggling to fill these positions with skilled workers, and they call them STEM workers, mm-hmm. right, for science and technology, engineering and math, here we have a ready population, whether they're documented or not. The Hispanic demographic is exploding. Right. By 2030, they will constitute about 30% of the American population. And if you think about that for a minute, it's also one of the lowest achieving pop demographics with respect to dropping out of high school. And there are a number of reasons for that, including poverty and pressure to work. These students are as capable, as bright, as imaginative as anybody else. And so if we don't support these young people, we are going to be, as a nation, I think, we will suffer, and the shine and luster of the American brand in the world economy will be seriously tarnished if we don't engage and captivate students like Oscar, like Lorenzo, like Luis, and like Christian. We as a country are going to be in very serious trouble. I mean, right now, 51% of Chinese students are pursuing STEM degrees or STEM courses versus 16% in the United States. That is where the growth is. It's in healthcare, it's in science, it's in technology, and we are lagging behind. And so I think it's really imperative. And it's funny, I think Kurt Steele in the film, a member of the MIT team and the founder and actually the inventor of the Apple earbud, said, you know, we should be encouraging anybody in this country who wants to build great things. Doesn't matter what they look like. They could be orange. They could be blue. Anybody. And that includes, by the way, not just undocumented students, but foreign students who are forced to leave the country, right? We have extraordinary graduates from MIT and Caltech and, you know, Wesleyan, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and all points in between, that are then forced to leave the country, and they're taking valuable skills with them. And again, if you're kicking out engineers, they're going to go find work somewhere else.
Let me play one more clip. I think most people know who Dean Kamen is. He is this remarkably charismatic, brilliant engineer. He created the Segway, among other different kinds of things. He's featured in the film. And he says this really provocative thing. As you noted, this idea, Proposition 300 is one of the obstacles that these four kids were up against in terms of trying to move forward as undocumented students. But also you mentioned, the states that require undocumented workers to pay out-of-state tuition for universities, how many of them are not eligible for financial aid, these kinds of things. And in this, again, kind of provocative clip, Dean Kamen talks about how it makes really no sense. You'll also hear the voice of Eugene Chudnovsky, a Russian scientist, in this clip, again, from Underwater Dreams.
If you look at U.S. policy on education, you would have to conclude that it was designed by the most thoughtful, insightful terrorists who have as their only goal to undermine and destroy America. As soon as that kid gets that valuable education, the moment they become a potential competitive threat. We will force them to leave the country. It defies logic. It's crazy.
It is absolutely a human rights issue.
Let me bring it to today. And as you know, there's this political impasse going on between the White House and Congress related to immigration policy. What does the story in your film, how does it relate to what's going on today? How do you make it, what do you think about what the relevance of it today?
Well, I think it's the big picture, right? That here we have people in this country that have the capability and talent to serve American business, right? That is a very central slash to right issue. And I think it's something that both sides of the aisle can get around. I think the challenge, and our film really focuses on dreamers, I think the challenge, of course, is what do we do with dreamer parents, which was the extension of the president's executive order, mm-hmm. right? And I think what most Americans don't realize is the number of U.S.-born children that become orphans or become parentless when their mother or father, who may not be properly documented, is deported. And that's a crisis. I mean, what I wasn't fully aware of before making the film is you have, they call them mixed families, mixed status families. So you might have three kids that were born in the United States and two kids that might have come here as babies. And once you kick out the parent, you have left those four or five young people. I can't tell you the number of young people that I met in the course of making this film that were left without parents at the age of 14, 15, 16. We are the greatest nation in the world with the greatest amount of resources. That lack of compassion and understanding, right, is absurd. And I think, again, we're coming head to head with policy issues. You know, we have a huge population of people in this country undocumented. The right, the left, the center all agree that we need to figure out how to support them, those that are here. You can deal with future immigrants in a very clear policy way, but for those that are here, we need to treat them and encourage them to serve our country.
It's Mary Mazzio, director of the film Underwater Dreams. Tomorrow night at 7 at the Tower Theater, the Hinckley Institute of Politics is going to be screening the film. It's part of their Siciliano Forum on U.S.-Latin American Relations. Oscar Vasquez, this is going to be a treat. He's going to be at the film on hand for a Q&A after the screening. Mary Mazzio joined us from a studio in Boston. Mary, thank you very much for the time.
Doug, thank you, and you will love meeting Oscar tomorrow night. He is just a gem.
We should also mention there are a limited number of free copies of the educational version of the film available to Title I schools and educators. Go to our website for the particulars, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.